Thundergrunt.
Hey guys, how are you?
Hi Bob.
I'm doing good.
Yeah, why don't you introduce yourselves?
I'm Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and full-time script consultant.
I'm Jamie Nash. I am a screenwriter.
I'm Bob Rose. I'm an independent filmmaker and a podcaster and just a really bad cook.
I was about to say hell yeah, and then you added the bad cook thing, and I was like,
that's okay. Not everyone can do everything, Jimmy. You know,
see, I'm a bad cook. I just don't cook.
I have to cook for myself. So
maybe I'm an undiscovered talent.
Yeah,
you might be.
Somebody
great.
Can shape you into a diamond.
The next Gordon Ramsay sitting right next to us. Yeah, he knows structure and he knows flavor. Anyway, today we're going to talk about a movie that is currently still in theaters.
Yeah.
And I think it's still kicking a little bit of ass, right?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yes.
Which is Mission Impossible 6.
Six.
Right, MI6.
Yeah.
And Jamie, do you have any of those statistics we always give out?
I did not.
Oh, I thought you did. I thought you pulled
this
it up.
This has become a running thing.
No,
I love it.
I always,
Jamie's like, I don't know. How much money it
tell
made.
Us why it's a blockbuster.
No, honestly.
You don't have to look it up.
More what I was thinking was talking about the franchise. That's what I was prepared to talk
about. Yeah.
Because we have this franchise here, the Mission Impossible franchise, that, you know, my father loved the television show as a kid. That was his. I don't know if he was a kid. I'd have to do the math on that. But when I was a kid, he used to always talk about this TV show. And then, of course, it came out. When was the
96.
First?
96. Brian De Palma.
Brian De Palma. That's the one where Tom Cruise gets the pig's blood on the
head. Yeah.
Right.
And it was a very different movie, right? It was kind of rooted in the 70s thing or something.
This franchise is interesting because it's every movie up until McQuarrie kind of came in.
Yeah.
Every movie was like a different director doing the most them they could make
exactly.
it. You know,
right.
The first movie is very Brian De Palma.
Yep.
The second movie is John Woo almost going too John Woo-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third movie is J.J. Abrams and, you know.
Doing all his stuff. I really like the third one, too.
Yeah, I'm actually a fan of all of them.
Me too.
Even though
except I haven't seen five.
Two is like a parody of itself,
yeah.
but I like it in that way.
Yeah.
But it's a franchise, I think, that no one ever expected.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean.
Definitely.
Because Ethan Hunt's not even a character from the popular TV show.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Also,
he's literally a character from a movie based on a TV show.
I would say the TV show, if I'm remembering correctly, had much more of a team-based approach.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody out front. It was definitely a group, you know.
And that's why I like Part 4. Part 4 is my favorite because...
Which
I
is
think,
Ghost Protocol.
I think
yeah.
Ghost Protocol. That's Brad Bird.
Brad Bird.
Because I think it does all the things you love about these movies, it does them to its best degree. You know, it's all about the team. There's tons of fun. Like all the aspects of these movies, like I think hit their peak at 4.
That also guaranteed, I think, that this was going to live on.
Yeah,
way farther than anyone thought.
You think
that
4 is?
No, I think 4 was like the one.
Its
4 was the
resurgence.
One. 4 was the one where it came out. I think that was when everyone was like, "Okay, you need to stop." And then it came out, and everyone was like, "Okay,
holy
go ahead.
Shit,
go,
it's still
going.
Good.
Keep going.
Yeah.
No
keep
way.
Going.
Okay, we want to see more.
Yeah.
Right." It worked. Yeah.
So just looking at the box office tally.
I'm sorry. Next time I'm going to say, look it up beforehand.
Right now it stands at about 161 mil in the domestic front. This is off of a $178 million budget.
Okay.
And it's about half a mil. It's 437 mil worldwide.
Worldwide.
So I wouldn't say that's a runaway crazy blockbuster. It's a solid.
For a sixth entry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't know if it's opened in China yet or anything.
Right,
like that,
And some people have theorized that actually MoviePass damaged those numbers a little bit.
Oh, yeah, because you can't use it.
Because that was the movie that was talked about most in the recent fall, you know. I'm dating this podcast right now by saying that, but MoviePass contributed.
I'm keeping my mouth shut because that's the whole thing. Like they're like trying to do a power play,
right?
To be like, see.
So anyway, franchise. Yeah.
And well, I was gonna jump to Chris McQuarrie. Is it McQuarrie?
I say McQuarrie, but
I have no idea.
We never can figure out how to pronounce
the names on this podcast.
Why don't we get like a Chris?
We really suck at the names.
Is it Tom Cruise or
Cruise?
So Chris, as I like to call him.
Yeah, just Chris Q.
Your buddy Chris.
My buddy Chris. He really kicked off his career with The Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
And did he win or get nominated for an Oscar for them?
I know it was at least nominated for the Oscar.
It was at least nominated.
Yeah.
And he became kind of Bryan Singer's guy.
Yeah,
for a little bit. No, but
he made a great movie called Way of the Gun.
Way of the Gun. Which he directed.
Yeah. Find that. We won't talk about it, but find that if you've never seen it. That's the great movie.
And it didn't do so well and kind of sent him into a funk in his career. And I think he was doing a lot of script doctoring work, rewrites and things. None really credited. I mean, if you look at his IMDb, and I'm looking at it right now.
Jamie, tell us about Chris McQuarrie's IMDb.
So it doesn't say how to pronounce his name, but it does say his first movie was, well, he has some older ones. He has like an NYPD Blue story by I don't know what that's about. We'll get him on the show.
He cut his teeth on the on TV.
So he started out with The Usual Suspects, went to Way of the Gun, and then after that, he doesn't have a credit for 8 years.
Wow.
And the next one was Valkyrie with Tom Cruise. So Tom Cruise kind of almost gave him that jump start to start, you know, falling in love with the movie making process again.
Yeah.
And Bryan Singer actually had to come in and direct Valkyrie, I think.
I don't know the story.
He did, because if that movie had a weakness, it was the directing.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
I remember being very disappointed in that movie.
I've never seen it.
The premise is so good, and the execution's not.
Gotcha. So, you know, after that, he really became... He was attached to the hip with Tom Cruise. There's some other things like Jack the Giant Slayer in here.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack Reacher, any movie called Jack.
Yeah, the Reacher. No.
the Robin Williams Jack. No, I don't know.
Right.
The Mummy he did recently with Tom Cruise.
Did he write the Mummy?
He came in for some rewrites.
Holy shit.
So... I think at this point, anytime Tom Cruise is in a blockbuster, he's like, you better come over here. And I've heard him talk a lot that he's now become, he calls himself, he's dubbed this himself, the blockbuster whisperer, you know? He worked on Rogue Nation.
Rogue One. Rogue One.
He didn't work on Rogue Nation.
That's hilarious. He did work quite a bit on it.
He did. So he did work on that. He's worked on some other things like The Mummy. And he's kind of brought in, like, on Rogue One, he was brought in during the rewrite phase.
Right.
But okay. I don't know. I don't see a credit. Maybe he's uncredited for it. But I know he did a lot of that work. And you know what's funny about that? When I watched The End, which is primarily what he did, it's very much a Mission Impossible heist
scene. Absolutely. Yeah.
Very much.
We got to press this and do this and do that. And, you know, very much like the scene at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about writing these, not to go on a rant here, but there's some great interviews with Chris out there on the Q&A podcast with Jeff Goldsmith. He's done one for Valkyrie and one for each of the last two Mission Impossible movies. And the interesting thing about these movies is there's no script.
That's so crazy.
There's no script. The last movie, they tried to have a script. They kept rewriting it. This time they had an outline and he just kind of writes it the whole time. I mean, these shoots are like 6 months long.
Right.
So he's writing as he goes.
So they're writing on the fly.
He refused to write any of the action scenes this time until they had locations. He said, I'm not going to write any of them. And he has like some kind of outline that something might happen. But he's very passionate about the fact that he goes into this with no script and kind of messes around. My friend called it... Mission improvisation, my friend Chris. You know, that's what he calls it.
The faith that the studio must have on that, too.
Yeah, I think Tom Cruise must have some help.
That's what I'm saying, the two of them.
Yeah.
And I think he really is held to the budget very strictly if he's going to try to pull
this
that
is off. What you got to work with.
Yeah, so I think what they, in the previous movie, what was the previous one?
Rogue Nation.
On the previous movie, I know they had a lot of the set pieces in place. And his job was to connect the dots on the set pieces.
On the set pieces.
And I've heard similar things from producers I know that have worked on various Tom Cruise projects, that Tom Cruise likes to rewrite all night. And he likes to change things on the fly. And he likes to say, what if I hang off a helicopter? And they just have to react. Yeah. And he's that guy. And I've heard both positives and negatives.
It's weird because what you're saying now, I feel like I heard the same things about The Mummy and why that failed.
Yes.
Was because he came in and did that exact thing.
I think.
But then on something like this, it seems like it's kind of its strength.
I think of different cultures. Maybe Universal was trying to protect their universe. And it was a wrestling match against, you know, how do we have this franchise, and how does Tom come in and say, I want to hang off the helicopter?
Yeah.
Which doesn't exactly work for a horror movie.
Exactly. It's the genre.
It's the genre
that
was the problem.
That.
Right. It's the genre that was the problem.
I mean, I do remember, I didn't listen to those. I can't wait to listen to
they're
this.
They're really good.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Chris is an excellent orator, and he's very charismatic. He's a really good interview.
Gotcha.
He's great.
Because what little I have heard a little bit of speaking about this, and they were saying that they came up with the set pieces and the stunts before the story. So they were like, okay, here are all the big things we want to do. We want to jump out of a plane. We want to have a helicopter chase. All of the things that are in there, that was the first step, deciding what we want to do and where the hell we're going to do it and who's going to let us shoot there. They said every single country turned them down for the helicopter chase except for New Zealand.
This is great too, because it also proves the point that not every movie is somebody sitting at their like laptop writing first.
You know
what I mean? Like,
but
movies
there is
are
something
made in
to be said
ways.
About there, like, okay, like there's some construction there, you know, like, okay,
Yeah,
you're good.
So there are two things that come to mind with that. I think Raimi on the second Spider-Man, they had the subway sequence done, but they didn't have a script.
Right.
They were like, they
We've
had already
talked
started
about that.
Working
yeah.
on it. But I always say, and I heard Chris say this in one of his interviews. he said that he you know, give him a box. And this is something I always say. If you start putting boundaries around me, my creativity flourishes. But if you just say
isn't working.
Yeah. If you tell me sit down and write a Mission Impossible movie, it's a little hard. But if you throw me four set pieces, I'll start connecting the dots.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is actually how I tend to work on screenplays anyway. I tend to come up with, you know, what would be a cool set piece? You know, what would be a cool this? You know, what would be a cool that? And then I start trying to figure out what works in the cracks. Different people have different methods.
I think that's...
If I could throw something out there, Jamie, because I know you do them. I'm not sure if you ever have, but it almost is like a film contest, like a 48-hour.
Like a 48.
You get your objective, your genre. What do we have? You find out what you have, and then you write.
That's right.
So that's like what McCory's doing just with $160 million.
Exactly. No, right.
Yeah,
but it
right.
is.
It's what
it's
he's
exactly
doing.
Exactly like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I do that not to the same degree as you. I've kind of been my entire career, you know, quote unquote.
It's a career.
Has been.
Don't insult yourself in your own show.
Yes. You know, one box after another. Like, we have this little resources to work with. What can we achieve with these specific resources in mind? So, like, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these techniques we talk about are boxes. And that's why I like them. Yeah. Genre is a box.
Right.
Those Blake Snyder genres are a box.
Right.
Structure is a box.
Right.
All this stuff's a box. And it's just stuff to help pull ideas out.
Yeah.
You know,
focus.
Yeah, allow you to start connecting dots and answering questions instead of just being out there with no questions.
And sometimes the magic isn't like how you conceive or write it. The magic's how you actually like save it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you have all these boxes. The art is actually making it a legible, fun, entertaining thing.
Exactly. Within these
parameters. Right.
Yeah,
and
totally.
So, I mean, it's a movie that is somewhat improvised, but what can we talk about its structure?
Well, it's funny that, want to throw this out there. Like, now that I learn all this, like, that what you just told me, there's, like, five moments in the movie where, like, they make these wink-wink jokes, like, how are you going to do this? Right. I'll figure it out. Tom Cruise says, I'll figure it out, like, five times.
It's almost
like
a meta joke at that
point. It's so meta. No, it's so meta.
And Chris McQuarrie has pointed out that same
thing. Oh, he has?
Yeah, he's pointed that same thing out. The funny thing about this, they said, I think one of the questions, not to spoil his interview, go listen to his interview, the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. he said, what would you do differently? And he said, I'd approach it with less of a plan. That was his.
Damn. Yeah, he's more improvisation.
And he's kind of a.
That's some balls.
That's a lot of balls, man.
Back in the Usual
he's
Suspect
Ethan Hunt.
Days.
Yeah. Christopher Corey is Ethan Hunt of
back
filmmaking.
In the Usual Suspect days, I mean, he was one of these screenwriters that me and a lot of screenwriters almost wanted to be like.
Yeah.
And he was almost like a writer's writer. So now for him to almost go to this other. It's almost like the sell outside. Yeah. Come up with the big pieces first.
Wouldn't you expect Michael Bay to say that instead? Yeah. Like, we'll just shoot a bunch of shit and we'll just figure it out later.
And,
right.
And I don't know how much you can take it as advice because I think he's working at such a high level.
Yeah.
And he's just so immersed in it.
Yeah. Also,
there's so much on the line.
Yeah.
And he's got so much craft and skill. Yeah. And I think he just brings it on the fly as opposed to in advance.
Yeah. I don't think
he's a really great filmmaker too. I mean, like, you know what I mean? It's not just his skill isn't just writing.
No, absolutely.
He can see all of it, every ounce of like the artistic nature that goes into every aspect of a movie, and he's putting it all together.
There's an auteur aspect to it.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah,
yeah.
And that gives him the edge over a lot of other people.
These last two
movies,
this whole franchise is auteur-ish.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the whole point of it. You know, yeah. And I guess he kind of owns it now because he wrote. He wrote the last one and directed the last one, but he wrote Ghost Protocol, right, with Brad Bird, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Right?
I think he came in a little
at
late
the
in the process.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And that I think that shaped the direction
The last three definitely feel cohesive as a chunk.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I didn't mean to derail the structure.
No, you weren't derailing it.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know about the Christopher Corey thing.
Me neither. I love hearing it.
Which I think is incredibly important to talking about.
Absolutely.
The
writing of this.
I did not know that, Jamie, so thank you.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, everything I'm going to say after this, I'm like,
also,
how the fuck is this possible?
It also just makes it all the more impressive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to actually go and see this movie one more time now.
No, I knew this going into this one, and I was massively impressed with the level of craft that's on display. I mean, he's writing in the editing room, he's writing on the set, he's writing before he shoots. The craft is still there. It's still a screenplay.
I wonder how many of these moments I'm gonna mention of moments of clarity were like ADR and just like things like Ving, get in here and say one thing.
He's a big ADR proponent.
And the editing tricks probably you don't even realize that it's a voiceover in between shots
also,
and not actually a line being delivered on screen.
We will get to the structure, don't worry.
Yeah.
But also
next
I want to say
next week.
It's kind of amazing too that something this huge is improvised and yet it's also being lauded as all practical.
Yeah.
It's not like it's not George Lucas. We'll do it in post.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean?
Like well, there's planning. Like, if you watch, there's some BTS. What I have watched, I should have listened to the Chris Q episode. But what I did watch is as soon as I got home, I was like so blown away by what they pulled off. And I had heard rumblings, but I hadn't spent any time trying to corroborate whether all this shit was real. And there's like a YouTube video somebody put together of all the BTS footage. It's like 45 minutes, and you can see with your eyes it's all practical. And
they erase the wires.
And they talk about the planning. But so for instance, after they pulled off the skydiving, they said this was a scene that was 3 years in the prepping. So they had been crafting it for 3 years. So they must have had some planning involved in all of these big set pieces,
and
even though they improvised.
Perfect scene too for that because their faces are covered. Mm-hmm. So the ADR you can write it later
exactly,
and you plan it. You just plan the stunt.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah, and this is a totally different podcast, but that scene alone, they were allowed to shoot it once a day.
Yeah.
And they had some special photographer that he was the only guy that could possibly pull off. He never shot a real film before. He just shoots stunts. And there were all these complications, and Tom had to fly down within 3 feet of him to be in focus, and he kept being out of focus. It was just crazy. I mean, it's insane.
They have that stuff.
I mean, we could
recorded,
geek out
Jamie.
About the stunts
all
day.
Okay,
and like you said, we're not that podcast.
Yeah, we're not that podcast.
We actually got some constructive criticism about that earlier. We'll stop geeking out about it, but you can't talk about this movie without even mentioning
it. Without talking about that stuff.
It's and what Jamie said makes it actually an important part of the actual script.
Definitely.
It's weird that it is.
I'm really shocked to learn that, but I believe it. Because you know they're so talented, so one of the things I want to talk about is I think this franchise in general, not just this movie, by its design of your mission, if you should choose to accept it, does like such an amazing job of presenting the goals clearly to the audience, right? Like, you're never not sure what the fuck they're trying to do, because we have this big presentation and it's visual and
kind of just a stroke of genius from the television show,
right?
Give credit where credit's
yeah
due.
No
right, yeah,
but it allows everybody to like sit back and go, okay, what are we trying to do? Okay, what's standing in our way? How long do we have to do it? Every single one of these sequences presents it at the beginning of it very clearly. And then because of how we're used to this story working, we forgive all these moments where Tom Cruise once again says, okay, we have to get this thing. We have this much time left. And these people are on our ass. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that being said, I wish a lot more people did this shit, because like so many scripts I read don't spend any time doing these things, like
laying out goals,
laying out the goals, laying out the threats against them, and laying out how much time we have to achieve the goals. Like, I read so many scripts that don't do any of those things. I'm literally reading 100 pages and it's never been made clear what the hell
is
the main character is trying to do.
this is also the perfect genre for laying it out,
right? It is. But you know, I would say that if you could, like, if you have a drama, right, if you're saying like, how do I make it clear what my main character is trying to do and all of these other things I just mentioned, you could take the Mission Impossible approach with your drama. You sure. know, find a way to dramatize.
Get a halo jump in there.
Yeah, yeah. No, but you know what I mean? To have the character say like, oh my God, like, this is what I'm, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. to make it visual. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
No, I get you.
Certainly all movies need those goals and
yeah,
things like
when
that.
You're dealing with your students, like, do you encounter issues with people understanding goals?
Yeah, I think. And you and I talk about it a lot, that photographable, I guess, is
filmable.
That the word? Filmable goal, as opposed to, like, I think what the trap a lot of people fall in is the goal is to feel better, or
right.
to be more happy about my life, yeah. or to get over grieving.
Right.
And it's hard to express that. So that's
isn't
fine.
That almost more theme-ish
it's,
a little bit?
It's
right.
this thing. Yeah. There's these two kind of separate, you know, sides of it. There's the internal struggle
right.
and the external struggle. And you can tell a story about somebody getting over grieving.
Absolutely.
But the thing about it is you need to make that a physical thing.
Right. It needs yeah. to be achievable in some way that we can see. Mm-hmm. Some sort of visual accomplishment, right? So like I'll ask a client when I'm not sure what the hell I'm supposed to be following, I'll like go back to them and I'll say, what do you think is your character's goal? And they'll say happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Say that's not something we can film.
Nobody wants to watch a therapy session.
Right, right.
Right.
So I think these movies, there's like a lesson to be learned of how effective it is when you understand what the characters are trying to achieve very clearly, and then you follow along as we have the rises and falls of achieving that thing, and then you're reminded, oh shit, we have 15 minutes left. Mm-hmm. You know, you can still translate that to a drama or a comedy in very similar ways.
Yeah, I once heard the quote, and I don't know who said this, you know, hopefully I won't screw it up. It's screenwriting is psychology turned into behavior, I think is what I see.
That's great.
And, I like that.
I really
think,
like that.
So psychology is an important component. Like some people forget the psychology.
Absolutely.
And just go with the behavior. But behavior, like from a behavioralist standpoint, all behavior is trying to achieve a goal by doing something.
Doing things.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's,
actions.
That is behavior.
Yeah.
So in order to do that, you need a goal. You need to have that. So you can trace all those things, but you need all the positions. You need psychology. You need the behavior. You need
for consistency. So yeah, I just thought when I was watching this movie, I was like, man, I wish the goals were as
you
clear.
Seen the other ones, some of the other ones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it.
No, that's why it's
that's
a
why
perfect
it's a great,
example.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's why it's great.
The interesting thing about this one too, unlike some movies have sub goals that take you in really directions. This one almost plays off of getting closer to the goal, getting further
absolutely
away.
Absolutely, it does.
So if you take something like we've talked about, like the sequence method, almost all of the sequences have this overarching.
Mm-hmm.
Define the sequence method real quick, just
so,
for any new
yep.
listener.
So the sequence method is when you kind of construct a story by creating 8 mini movies.
Yeah.
And each mini movie has its own goal, and it kind of functions as its own movie,
yeah.
a short film, if you if you will.
In this case, it would be like 8 set pieces.
8 set pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Or,
I didn't count them. Did you?
There's more.
There's more than 8.
There's more than 8, but when it breaks down from a storytelling standpoint, it's 8 sequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that this one perfectly kind of breaks down into that.
Yeah.
There's another things we've talked about before, like McGee's value change kind of thing. And I noticed that heavy in this script as well. So value
change.
It's
not something we've talked about on this podcast.
We haven't
talked
about it? I don't know. For some reason, I thought we did.
Oh, Solo, I guess
maybe.
We did. Yeah.
No, we absolutely talked about it on Solo because the opening, we talked about like the opening chase, like all of a sudden he's up, he's down,
he's up, he's down, he's up,
right.
So, and that's what McGee basically says. He says that there's some change in the universe. There's some stakes for the character. There's some stake of value. And in a movie like this, it could be as simple as, will he get the what is he after, the plutonium, the detonator?
The first one is he's got to buy black market plutonium from a terrorist.
And
right.
The whole thing is pretty much trying to chase the plutonium up until
it
becomes weaponized.
But he gets an opportunity right at the second scene.
Absolutely.
And it's negative. Loses it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So another, there's a whole bunch of people that use this concept. This isn't unique to McGee.
Yeah.
Save the Cat rips it off and says you should use it. I mean, acknowledges the ripoff. There's another, I think I mentioned before, there's this guy, I think his name's Dominic Swain, and he wrote a book about novels. And he says every scene is a sequel. Is a scene in a sequel.
Okay.
And what he means by that, really how it breaks down, is every scene is either proactive or reactive.
Interesting.
So you have a scene like Ethan loses the plutonium. The next scene is a reaction to that.
And it is. It is.
It's literally the point of the movie. It's the fallout from his decision to save his team members. It's the fallout. Yeah.
And
this is also similar to what we pointed out to the Trey Parker method of saying and therefore instead of saying and then.
Absolutely. Yeah. So every scene goes up, down, up, down. So you have a proactive thing that Swain says always ends in disaster. So the proactive scene is, I'm going to get the plutonium, and it ends in disaster. We lost the plutonium. And then there's a reactive scene that ends in the decision to do the next thing.
Gotcha.
And that's the way I always like viewing it that way.
I like
the
that.
Plus minus.
Yeah.
So I always try to look at my scripts and say, do the beats go? And the beats aren't always scenes. Sometimes two scenes make a beat or half a scene will make a beat.
Yeah.
But I'm always looking for that proactive, reactive, proactive, reactive. The proactives always end in disaster. And the reactives always end in a new decision to be made somewhere. There's other intricacies, which I'll let you read the book.
Yeah, but it makes sense. It helps. That will help with construction big time. I like that.
Yeah,
a lot.
It's useful to do that checklist. And just like you said, it fits right in with the causality of scene to scene.
Right, right.
So, you know, I
do you
think
this is something that McQuarrie or Chris, is our friend, our buddy.
Yeah.
do you think this is something that even while like improvising this giant movie, he's well aware of? Like,
absolutely.
How could he not be? It may be
just instinctual.
I was going to say, I don't think he's out there saying, well, we need a positive reaction, a negative reaction.
He's
right.
I listen to Writers Blockbusters.
Yeah. They told me.
The Han Solo
sequels.
Tom, you gotta listen to the Han Solo podcast.
Now, what did Jamie say? Now, let's not forget what Jamie said.
He's quoting some book. We'll have to find it. And one interesting thing when you're outlining your projects, you can realize, and I'll point to one of these, if something doesn't go from a negative to a positive. So if you have a proactive scene that just ends in victory, you know, it's just like, I got my thing. Usually their scenes or the opposite, the reactive scene that just ends in, I still don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They're usually scenes that can be cut. They're usually indicative of scene that can be cut. And I'll tell you a scene in this movie that struck me that early is the parachute scene, the jump. You could, I'm not saying you should, but you could cut that scene.
Oh,
and just,
please don't cut it.
Yeah. And just start right in
I get what you're saying.
You know, they walk in.
Right.
It really has no bearing on the mission.
No.
It's.
I agree completely.
It could totally be cut.
It's inconsequential because it doesn't really change from positive to negative.
Yeah. It's just that an act of breaking into a place that they get. You're right, and they just go in.
There's rises and falls within it. Huge rises and falls within that
within
sequence.
That scene, there's
but
a back and forth.
The ultimate events don't matter.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that scene would it basically the charge value. I guess it would be a proactive scene that goes to a proactive.
Yeah, it's,
so it's a plus
it's positive
to a plus.
To positive. I've got. Yeah.
You mean the bathroom fight?
Oh,
no.
Just the part.
Just landing on the thing.
Just the actual act of landing.
It's like, we got a plan. We're going to do it. We're going to get in there. And it starts as a plus, and then they land, and it stays
at a
plus.
You could work that whole chunk to
absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
That whole thing was kind of the raid and the...
Yeah,
you know,
you could say it starts with a plus and then ends with a negative when the computer's broke and they can't replicate the mask.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
it just depends where you're putting the points
and that's,
the markers.
Lot of the positives in this movie have a negative with them, which is their goal in that sequence was to get into the club and to replicate his face and assume his identity, right? So they got who they think is Lark, so that's positive. That was their goal, but they only achieved half the goal, and now he has to assume the identity with his own fucking face, you know?
Yeah, right.
So even though it's positive, it kind of feels like it has a negative connotation to it, and there's a lot of those in here. I didn't note all of them, but almost all the positives, there's something negative to go along with it.
Yeah. Well,
can I just interject real quick?
Yeah.
I thought that scene of the entire movie, I know in a movie filled with him doing death-defying things that are absolutely insane, I thought for some reason that defined his character the best. When he was like, when she was like, well, he might have seen your face. And he's like, well, I'll just have to take that chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he literally walks into, like, he could die instantly without
question.
Well,
that raises the stakes, you know?
It's just a great Ethan Hunt character moment where he just... he'll walk into anything.
Yeah. And those reactive.
They know the character, is what I'm saying.
Those reactive decisions you're talking about, like, you know, I'm going to walk in and do this.
Yeah.
There are always these decisions that another thing that Swain says, there's usually a dilemma in the decision. So the dilemma is we could play it safe or we could go for it.
Right.
And he goes for it. So there's more tension.
The whole franchise is going for it.
I mean, so proactive doesn't necessarily mean safe.
Yeah.
It just means... okay, we got a plan. Let's do
right.
it. It could be filled with tension.
They're moving in a positive direction toward that overall goal.
Overall goal.
Right.
They reacted to the setback, and they have a new plan.
And that's why I'm not as well versed on the McKee positive and negative value changes, but I know that the core idea of it is those positive and negative changes are all related to that overall goal.
Yeah, and I think Bob made an excellent point before.
Finally.
Where one of the knocks on this is you can put these pluses and minuses anywhere you want.
Mm-hmm.
It don't have to be between a scene. There's no rule or anything.
Yeah.
But I think that's also the beauty of it. Your whole story is doing plus, minus,
it
plus,
should
minus,
be.
Plus, minus.
Right.
So even the beats of your individual scene, whether you're having a conversation with somebody and you're having a little chess match, it's going plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. It's just a way to look at your outline.
And
you know,
honestly,
make sure it has these things.
We talked about this on Solo, and ever since we've talked about it on Solo, I've been thinking about it in every script I read. A lot of people don't do this. A lot of people don't. A lot of people will have a scene, and it has that overall value at the end, right? It ends negatively, or it ends positively, but there's nothing in between. You know, those good news, bad news that you've talked about in the past?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this movie excels at the good news, bad news. I mean, a two-minute scene will have six good news and six bad news in this movie. And a lesser craft would just have it all end up good. There'd be no, like, back and forth.
It's a great genre for that, too, as far as, like, action, because, you know, you can physically make the good, bad.
Yeah.
With just like, you know, a physical attribute happening. He falls over. He gets up. He gets punched.
Yeah.
He punches. You know,
exactly.
It's perfect.
So I just thought, you know, it's easy for us to say, but you really have to be mindful of this in every scene that you write.
Yeah.
You know?
And when you don't know what to write, these are those things like putting you in a box that can help you, especially early on. Once you kind of get the story down, you can kind of just start going for feel. Sometimes in that outline phase, you need little helpers like this just to help you out.
Exactly.
And this whole movie is an outline phase.
It is. You're right.
Yeah. I mean.
So you're saying that this. Did you put this in 8 scenes? Is that what you did?
Like 8 sequences? Yeah. I mean, okay, do we really need to go through it? I mean, man, we don't. Yeah,
Jimmy, if you're excited about something, no. I feel like we should run with it. We did that with Solo. I mean, Jamie, what do you think?
Go for it.
Speedy Gonzalez.
Go for it. Let's
fucking go. Are you guys ready?
What would Chris do?
What would Chris Q? I'm going to tag him in this when we post this on Twitter. Maybe he'll be like, I didn't realize I did all that. I was just improvising. I know. I think there's intent, creative storytelling intent for all of these decisions. So as you spoke of, there is a very clear from the very first scene overall goal presented, and which creates like a central story question, which is, will Ethan and his team prevent Lark Lane and the Apostles from creating nuclear weapons and starting a new world order? So mm-hmm. those are the main overall stakes mm-hmm. and antagonism, right? And goal. Okay, so the first sequence is he has to buy black market plutonium from a terrorist arms dealer, which ends in a negative. Because they fail.
They fail.
You know, because he chooses Luther's life over, and the whole movie follows over the world.
Yeah.
And the whole movie follows that and says, you should have chosen the world, you know, but time and time again, Ethan chooses the people that he cares about to first, and that's what ultimately always leads to his success in these movies.
Well, that, and I think the movies have actually come to that.
Yes.
I think 3 was the turning point where it changed him into that character.
I think that, and now, when he got married.
When he got married, and now McQuarrie's working off of that.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, this movie felt like a response to 3 almost more than anything.
It's a good point.
Like, now Ethan because Hart the beginning isn't alone.
Is kind of like hearkening back specifically to
the
end
what
of
he
3.
Used to be. Right, yeah, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah.
We can talk about that in the character arc side.
Yeah.
But so the second sequence is very short, but it is its own sequence, and that is the hospital set where they trick the... They trick the nuclear scientist but they have a specific goal, and it's presented like at the very beginning of that scene with the cell phone, which is, will they get the nuclear weapons scientist to give them the phone password to get the plans?
Yeah, by the way, how great is that for an exposition scene?
Oh, it's
it's perfect, and it's got a punchline and everything. Like,
right.
What a perfect scene.
If there's one scene in this movie that I will remember when I'm writing, I'll remember that scene. I'll
Me
say,
too.
I need exposition that good.
Me too. Like,
that is a goal to strive for.
And not only that, it kind of foreshadows how it could go if they don't
Absolutely.
Succeed. You know, they show you the
it
end.
Actually,
it's perfect. It's kind of a perfect
setup. The scene
setup.
Tricked me for in the beginning.
No,
like,
yes.
It was called Fallout. I was like, oh, wow, they're going there. This is cool. It was a little darker.
It Mission starts Impossible, with
the,
this?
It starts with the world just going to shit.
I literally was like, it fucking starts with this? Where
impressed.
Does it go?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, they give you the ending. And a lot of, this is going to veer off, but I always like to bring in testimony from when I'm reading scripts, because I read scripts all day from people who aren't professionals and are working to get better. And a lot of people don't understand that you want the audience to see the end in their heads. Like, that's important. You can have twists and turns and surprises, but ultimately you want to give them a visual idea of what they should be rooting for to happen on screen, you know?
Or not to happen.
Or not to happen, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what we, yeah.
Yeah.
And this scene, like, shows you the potential ending that we're building to if all of the events don't happen the way that we needed to. It's just
As
brilliant.
Though it were concurrent.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
The genius
I
of the
know,
scene is.
I know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that sequence, their goal is to get the codes, and they do. It's a positive, right? So, it's a short sequence. It's, like, 4 minutes long, but it's a sequence. And it's also a set piece, even though it's... And I love how this movie... does it really starts intimate, like the set pieces are really small, and then they get bigger, and then they get bigger, and then they just fucking end with a helicopter chase and a fight on a cliff of a mountain, like as big as you could possibly get. But if you watch it, like, they really do pace the level of the set pieces mm-hmm. too. But the third sequence is the skydive, which I completely agree with Jamie that ultimately it doesn't matter. I mean, you needed them to get out of the plane onto the building, but like, not much changes, you know. It's definitely,
like you said, they were planning it for like years.
Yeah.
It's staying in that movie, and honestly, I don't think the audience would—they're not gonna like judge it. For
no, they're
that
not, because it's exciting. It's like, holy shit! But
it's part of the meta the meta of this movie. It's,
the reason you'd cut that is if it was boring, which it's absolutely not.
No,
or
if time needed it. You know, you just need it for time and pacing.
Yeah, exactly.
And neither seemed to be.
No, yeah.
This movie gets started so fast that I think it can afford that kind of, you know.
Right, yeah.
You can take that those side trips because it starts like on page one.
Yeah, it gets right in. It does jump right into it.
You just don't cut a Halo jump.
No.
You just don't.
But, okay, so the third sequence is, can they skydive from the plane onto the location in Paris where that meeting is happening that they need to get to? And it ends in a positive. They do. There's trials and tribulations amidst it, but ultimately it's a positive. Okay, so then the fourth sequence is the club, the EDM club. Mm-hmm. I loved watching Tom Cruise and Superman go through this EDM club.
right?
It's just so cool. And so they have a very clear goal that they set up, which is find Lark, assume his identity, and then go meet with the White Willow as White Widow. And how are they going to do that? They make it visual by they give you a cell phone to track Lark, right? So it's visual. Once again, we can follow it. And it's positive, but it's negative. They get who they think is Lark, but they can't assume his identity. So even though it's a positive change, there are negative connotations with it. And then the fifth one takes a while to get to the fifth one. The fourth one sort of has this like really long denouement where he like meets with the White Widow and like they talk about like what they're gonna do. But
it's establishing her. That's the job.
And I love that they kind of show you once again with the nuclear blast while you're being told the next plan. They show you him killing a cop. So it's like, just like the nuclear blast, like this is how this next sequence could go wrong, you know?
Right.
And while it was happening, I was like, I've never seen anything like this in a movie. Like, is this what's actually, are we seeing the next scene while the plan is being discussed? Like, it was very interesting.
I've seen movies that do kind of yada yada over the plan to get to the next step. This would have been such a character turn. It would have.
Yeah.
And listening to the interview, apparently the movie was going to be more about Ethan having to do these horrible things to prove who he was, but they changed that as they went. That was a major change.
They toned it down.
They just said it didn't feel like a Mission Impossible movie or something.
Gotcha.
And they kind of changed direction there.
Gotcha.
Well, they changed it to him like having to pay for making the right decision.
That's right.
So it was right.
I mean, that's what the theme now is.
Okay.
Right.
You can feel that sinister turn into the dark side. Temptation on in all of those scenes.
But
that next sequence is to extract the terrorist Solomon Lane, who they got captured in the last movie, in order to get the plutonium spheres. And they present this big plan and they make it visual how we're going to do that, but they reverse our expectation by Ethan with his team doing a completely different plan, right? And ultimately it leads to positive. It feels like it's got this extra positive to it because he did it so differently, you know, than it was planned, and it feels like almost like an extra accomplishment.
It's a plus plus.
It's like a plus plus, right? Yeah, like the last one was a plus minus and this one's a plus plus. But I think
the movie does a good job of hiding things from the audience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in a way that doesn't feel cheap or lame. It feels motivated, right? And you can still follow along just enough so when the surprises come, you're like, oh, and there's that. Okay. But one thing I wanted to say as we talk about these positive and negative changes, as you can see, like, there's nothing wrong with having like two positive changes in a row or two negative changes, as long as it always is addressing that overall goal. That's all that matters,
right?
Like, you can have them keep having successes as long as like it's very clear what we're building to, you know what I mean? Because a lot of times I'll read a script where like good shit's happening, but it's like, what does it have to do with anything? Like, and this one, it's very clear that all of this stuff is ultimately to get that plutonium. So then the sixth sequence is they have to meet the White Widow in London, and she'll hand over the plutonium as long as he gives her both Ilsa now. He's got to get Ilsa too.
Yeah, right. Ilsa's a factor in the whole thing.
He's
got
to get Ilsa and hand over the guy who he just captured in the last movie in order to get the plutonium. It actually ends, it's a double negative. There's two turns in this sequence, and it all happens both at the end, which is instead the CIA tries to take Ethan's team in, And Walker turns out to be Lark. And so the complete goal of the sequence changes to capturing Walker through the streets of London. So it starts out, you're given like a clear goal at the beginning of the sequence of what he's supposed to do. And then, unlike the other stuff in this movie, the goal completely shifts.
And by the way, the scene in the subway with Alec Baldwin, mm-hmm. that was the scene they said was rewritten at the last minute.
Oh.
So I don't know what the original scene was. He was a little canny about what it was, but he said he did not have that scene when they went to that set.
Really?
Yeah, it was like it came. It might have even happened after the leg break incident.
We'll figure it out.
They figured it out. So he said that was a major change in the whole movie.
On the fly.
On the fly.
I don't know about on the fly, but written the night before or whatever.
So that's why it feels like suddenly.
That seems like such a huge scene, too.
I know.
I think it was another huge scene, but then he just didn't feel.
Well, you know what? As long they probably knew that
Walker was going to be outed,
and that maybe Alec Baldwin
was going to die.
Was going to die, and he wasn't. Because it opens with all him of those against the end, right?
Yeah, so they just truncated it into one sequence instead of two.
Making it,
because technically, if you watch it again, I had originally boxed this out structurally as two different sequences, but they're not. Like it's London is its own sequence, right? Mm-hmm. So like London just suddenly, because they switch that shit on the fly, mm-hmm. changes like the goal of the sequence changes, and so it's a double negative. The CIA fucks everything up, and the IMF leader gets killed, Alec Baldwin, and then Walker turns out to be Lark, and then they lose him. They don't capture him, so it's a negative. The next scene, they really skip forward, right? Like, they're like, let's follow Solomon Lane to wherever he's going, and it's just kind of like them talking over, like voiceover over traveling across the world, kind of like the Indiana Jones map.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels a lot like the Indiana, we watch this thing,
yeah.
and we skip forward in time, but they track Lane to the humanitarian camp, and this sequence, it is its own sequence, kind of feels like the Solo sequence where they're on the planet and nothing mm-hmm. really happens, mm-hmm. right? They're just kind of chilling out, waiting for the next sequence to happen.
It's also, I viewed it as kind of a breath.
Absolutely. And just like Solo.
For a movie that's breathless. Yeah. For a movie that's so breathless, yeah.
So, but by the end of the sequence, they have to find the bomb. They have to find both bombs, but they find one bomb. And they find the detonator, but they don't get it. So it's positive because they're moving forward
mm-hmm.
toward getting those nuclear weapons, but they don't actually achieve anything. Mm-hmm. But I would call that almost like a positive negative, right? Because they went there. They're like, we got to find the bombs. We got to get the detonator. They don't really do either of them, you know, but they have direction. But that's how it ends, like the sequence.
The fact that they know what they need to do is the positive.
They know what they need to do.
Yeah,
right.
That's
it's
like
a positive.
But it's bad because
they don't have it.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but it is interesting how a lot of these turns in this story kind of, it's like, well, there's good news to our success and there's bad news to our success even, you know. And then the last sequence is the cliff sequence and defusing the bombs. I mean, and they do it.
It's pretty self-explanatory.
One thing I noticed that you reminded me of when I was watching, we've talked about the 5-point finale a few times. One thing they do in the finale really nicely here is each person has something to do. And
right.
It works really well. But what I realized watching this movie with the 5-point finale is because this movie, the sequences are so heist-based.
Mm-hmm.
The 5-point finale is a heist.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
And almost all their little sequences are 5-point finales to mm-hmm. an extent. They each have a gathering the team. They come up with a plan. They storm the castle.
That's
they
so
get surprised.
True.
They dig deep. They execute a new plan. And then
they each have their own. It's the bomb defusing that Ving Rhames is doing. Then it's Simon Pegg
and Ilsa.
And Ilsa going to the cabin. And
then
it's Tom Cruise and
Solomon. Yeah.
Right. So you've essentially got three endings happening all simultaneously.
Yep.
Yeah. That would be good enough for one movie.
Right. Exactly.
But even something like, I don't know, when they do the halo jump and stuff like that, and that's almost a 5-point finale unto itself.
Yeah,
you know, it's
definitely.
Like, let's plan. Let's do this. And then there's a twist. Then they have to come up with a new plan. And so I realize that that's just like a heist structure in some ways. Or
it definitely feels like it. Yeah. I didn't really think about it.
So you're saying it's a bunch of mini heist movies.
But now they could almost be TV episodes. So they're
of their own. Yeah. This is a series finale.
Yep.
Well, in the end, yeah, you got two, essentially you have two team movies, because you've got, you know, Ilsa and Benji, yeah. And then you've got Ving Rhames and Julia. Yeah, right, yeah. And they're doing the bomb movie, and yeah. Then we can talk about character later, but then you just got Ethan.
Yep. Yeah.
Symbolic.
Dude.
Right there, the lonely man.
Man, you did a good job. I had forgotten to say exactly like what McKee said about value changes, and that you triggered me to be able to like talk about it so simply at the end of these sequences.
McGee's is a little hard to decipher.
Yeah, I've
sort of had to read five different.
We break it down simply.
Figure out what's intuitive to me.
Yeah.
Before we get to character arc and Ethan and everything, do you want to talk about the ticking clock mechanism?
Okay,
thing? I know so, we sort of have, but I feel like this movie is so dense with.
Okay,
so
I won't. And you can bounce off me because I don't want to monopolize all this shit. I feel like I'm talking a lot.
How dare you into a mic
dare you.
We're gonna set a ticking clock.
A ticking clock on Jimmy's
right.
voice.
There's a bomb under this table.
No, so I want to talk about stakes real quick. I won't go through and list all of them, but this is a masterclass in raising the stakes. Every single sequence raises the stakes three or four times within a single fucking scene.
Mm-hmm.
And like let's take a minute and like talk about stakes and what they are, because I feel like there's a lot of people don't really conceptualize it well and like what the purpose of stakes are. What I think it like gets lost is, once again, they need to be visual. Like we talk about.
Yep.
Yeah. Like it's what is something that you can film as a writer that your character will suffer or some sort of punishment if they don't achieve the goal.
Hence, so, going back to that hospital scene.
Yeah, exactly.
We actually saw
right.
what would happen.
Exactly.
If they don't know, then all of Ethan's almost suicidal, you know, tendencies are ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because if he could just go home and take a little break, then all that stuff he's doing doesn't make sense. So in this movie, you need the ultimate stakes.
Yeah, yeah. But exactly. And it does a great job.
You need his insanity to be sane.
Yeah, exactly.
And how do they achieve that? By you understand his motivation. And like I think a lot of writers forget about the importance of understanding a character's motivation. And how do you present motivation to an audience? That's through stakes. What do they have to gain or what do they have to lose? And this movie, it raises like what they have to lose is consistently being crazier and crazier. The potential losses just grow and grow and grow. This movie raises
out of the whole franchise. This is that is the hook of this movie more than all of
them. Yeah.
It really is.
I agree completely. Yeah. It feels the most, like, most, there's most potential for loss in this movie than the others.
No, it's about his own loss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ving Rhames,
Luther
pretty much lays out in his little diatribe about Ethan at the end.
Yeah.
Like, he lays it out. Yeah. Like, this is why Ethan is Ethan.
I love that scene. That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
Where he's talking about how,
And that's the thing about being a franchise. This movie, as it's grown, there is friends, and there are friends, and we like to see them, and they have good camaraderie. Whereas in the second movie or the third movie, maybe we wouldn't have cared so much.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I don't think Ving Rhames ever thought he'd be still making movies.
No, yeah. No way. I don't think any of them thought. Maybe Tom Cruise, because he probably thinks he's going to make
Simon
50
Pegg was
more.
Like, he was a cameo.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and now he's like indispensable almost.
But I just think... I read a lot of scripts that do a lot of things right and then completely ignore things, right? And one of the things that gets ignored often is stakes. Like, nothing's at stake. And, like, basically, like, the events of the story, if, like, what they're trying to achieve don't happen, it doesn't matter. Like, the character's life could go back to the way it was, you know? But in this movie, every single scene... Like, if the goals aren't achieved, then their lives could never go back to the way they were before it. So
makes sense.
Worry about the stakes, man.
It's not I think we've insulted some movies on this podcast for only having world stakes.
Yeah.
But this movie definitely has world stakes, and it's weird because if they fail at any moment. It's not only the world, it's like personal.
Oh, it's personal.
It does
every
a really
scene.
Good job of keeping it personal and the world.
It makes
at
it
every
broad
moment.
And personal. Absolutely.
Yeah, it does a really great job of that.
And in some ways, his decision in the beginning of the movie lays blame. So that's where it's really a personal thing.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
his fault. If the
There's
world
guilt
blows
dripping
up.
Off the whole movie.
Yeah. And that sets the tone for it. You know, mm-hmm. that kind of makes you remind every scene like, oh, shit.
Something I noticed, too, is we were talking about that Luther scene. It's like the whole movie is based around his decision to keep Luther alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's like at the end of the movie, it ends with this like really beautiful scene of Luther explaining how much he loves Ethan and the fact that he knows Ethan better than anyone on the planet.
Yeah,
and it's like at that moment, you're like, yeah, Ethan made the right decision.
Yeah.
He mm-hmm. saved the one person he had more than anyone.
It almost like you know? Takes the moment to justify the decision. Like, let's
I'm saying
make
the movie
it clear.
Like took the whole,
it,
like all this stuff is crazy stuff's happening. And then the really the thing that justified the whole movie was Luther proving that he is like Ethan's family.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a good segue into the character
it
stuff.
Is.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
That's why that's exactly what I was thinking.
The,
right.
Because the one thing I was wondering during this movie, and I only saw the movie once, and I'm blown away by all the stunts and stuff, so maybe I missed this, is does Ethan have an arc in this movie? I argue that just what you said, he made the right decision in the beginning, and that's the decision he'd make in the end. So I do not believe he has an arc. I don't
I think the arc changes. I think the arc is he questions... This movie, more so than the other ones, I feel like he questions the entire time if he did the right
thing. That's right. So,
and at the end, I think he's sure that he did.
So there,
does that mean?
There's a thing called a flat arc.
Right.
And the flat arc is it's less about somebody changing. It's more it's that thing we talked about once before where this person, that arc of awesome kind of thing, where they change the world around them, but the world
yeah.
makes them question
Superman.
Whether it's a Superman.
Superman.
It's the exact thing.
Yeah.
And really
a
this
good
is
Superman story does
yeah.
this. Right.
Should I save Lois Lane or the world?
Right.
You know, it's that
it's
right.
the world challenging the character, not the character challenging themselves.
Yeah.
That's right. And even yeah. in the end, I can't remember what the CIA head's name is. She says something like, I realize now we need people like you.
Yeah.
So the world changed because of Ethan's decision, or they
right.
realized why. But he doesn't change. But the key to those flat arcs is to present some doubt, is to present that struggle and have him struggling with, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the wrong thing? Did I screw it up? Am I to blame? And then by the end, he realizes he did the right thing. And he doesn't really change. You know?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
the world does.
No, his foundation, his DNA, if you will, is the same.
Yes.
But the, yeah.
That's right.
He knows his actions were justified.
That's right.
That's the only thing he ever worried about.
It's sort of, for me, like a TV episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like in a TV episode, you
it's
got
a TV
a character,
show, characters don't change.
A character
right, yeah.
just has a small change to make by the end of the episode. And they present the problem at the beginning. And for this one bookends the guilt with all the things that all the people he cares about are dealing with as a consequence of his
right.
fucking maniacal need to save the world, every single
at
person that he
cost.
Cares about at any cost. So he's right. got like a core of like three people in this planet that he cares about, and they're all almost dying at every moment because of the shit that he's doing. And at the beginning, like, he's having nightmares about the fact that like everybody is suffering because of him. And I feel like by the end, I agree with you completely. Like, it's like a superhero movie, mm-hmm. right? He changes the world. The world doesn't change him. But there is like that TV, I feel guilty. And by the end, like his wife says, it's okay, I'm happy. And he says, you're happy? And she says, I'm happy. And then he smiles. And then there's this, it's visual, you know, we get like he's at peace, like he's no longer guilty.
There's especially since McQuarrie came into these movies, there's like a very selfless nature to Ethan Hunt. He doesn't care about his own life.
Right, yeah.
He only cares about, he is a superhero. He only yeah. cares about getting it done and that the people he loves are okay. There's no, he obviously yeah. doesn't care about his own well-being.
yeah, he just
at any right, no, like it's
jumping in a helicopter.
He's a bullet train going full speed
yeah.
ahead, and he will do
yeah.
anything. There's
yeah. I
there's
won't
never,
let you down. So.
There's never a moment of hesitation even portrayed
right.
on his part
yeah.
that I will not do something to save the world or anyone.
It's interesting. What I realized about the flat arc too is flat arcs are based in doubt. Like, did I do the right thing? Am I right? Should I change? Maybe, I don't know. And then they realize, nah, you know, but it fits into that model. We always say that there are the two arcs, one to care more and one to be more confident.
There it is.
So he got more confident.
Last time he couldn't put his finger on it. This time. Yes, Jamie, they're so good.
Well, I remember I added a third one.
You did. It's the team.
Work as a team.
I think you could also point the praise we could put on this. You could probably put on 3 too, because I feel like the marriage was that too.
Yeah.
Like, did I do the right thing by getting married?
Yeah. Exactly. He feels
he's
guilty.
The fallout from that has been the last, you know, three movies. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. The whole thing has been doubt. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a perfect arc. Awesome. So. Yeah.
The flat arc. That's good, man. I'm going to use that again.
Flat arc.
Which is something I think that most people don't understand. There's a flat.
Yeah.
Right. The great example, too, is Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Marty. He is unchanging character.
Time itself is changing.
And
he doesn't budge. Actions, but he is not changing. Right. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. With talking about Ethan, do you guys have anything else you want to say about Fallout?
I mean, I wanted to talk about one other thing. I didn't talk about the ticking clock mechanisms. I will just say that there's fucking 23 of them in this movie.
God, you can't.
Insane. I counted. It matters. I'm a big counter.
This is math to Jimmy George, man. It's
writing
amazing.
Is math for me.
I know.
Writing is math. I'm going to do a big ass blog post about it. Everything. Okay. The number one note I make on all scripts that I read is, for the love of God, make it harder. Make it harder. Fuck.
Explain.
Every 9 out of 10 scripts I read, all of the victories that the characters achieve happen with almost little no complication. And like, people will literally, like, I'll give you an example. I'll change the scenario so I'm not like specifically insulting a client. I was reading a script that involved a treasure. Okay. The treasure was stolen, and the goal of the story was to get the treasure back, right? The characters literally arrive at the place where the treasure should be with the people who stole the treasure. And the people who stole the treasure are sitting in a tent, and the treasure itself is unguarded, and the characters, after the whole movie, walk up to the chest and take it away. And that's it. There's, I mean, there's absolutely
wasn't that pleasant.
there's absolutely no complication. It couldn't be easier. And what happens is, you as an audience are unsatisfied, because you're like, if I could fucking do it myself, then like, why should I be watching somebody else do it? You know what I mean?
Why is it a story at all?
Right. Yeah. This movie makes every single scenario as hard as it can be. And I'm just going to talk about one scene, and just what a great example. When they arrive, they finally, in the act three, they follow the terrorist and they find where he is, right? Okay. He's got a nuclear bomb and he's going to detonate it. Where is he going to detonate it? Shit. It's in a body of water that's going to eradicate like 3 countries just by destroying it. So that's number one. Okay. Then it's at a humanitarian camp full of doctors who just got rid of smallpox for like thousands of people who had just previously been attacked by terrorists. Then this is all in the same 2 minutes. They get there and they're like, okay, how are we going to succeed? They have to find a nuclear weapon in a camp filled with X-ray machines, MRI machines. So it's literally everywhere they look, it appears that there's a nuclear weapon there, right? So it's almost impossible to find these things. Then they have to also avoid Solomon Lane, the terrorist, John Lark, the terrorist, and his militia, who are all there. Visual, we see them. They have to not let them know that they're there while doing all this. This is all in like 2 minutes. And then while they're trying to figure this out, who pops up but Ethan's wife? And as if that's not bad enough, here's her husband.
Yeah, so you got like this person
that he has to now not only cover for himself and make up some fucking story on the fly while they're trying to find two nuclear weapons, but he also has to cover for her.
But couldn't they have given her 3 beautiful kids and a dog?
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Right,
Jimmy.
But like,
let's blow up a puppy. Let's put that there.
It's just like when the husband moment came, I was like, this is fucking awesome. Like, I can't believe this. Like, they literally make it both broad and personal as hard as possible to achieve these goals. Right. And I just I read script after script that would just approach this sequence. Like, they get there, there's a tent full of bombs, and they go into the tent, and the bomb is there. Like,
it's, yeah, it's a scenario that only the character you've created at this point could even remotely deal with. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much pressure on Ethan that only someone that's kind of not a human being could deal with it.
But, like, yeah.
Yeah, so. I know. I was just going to say, I mean, that would be my lesson learned, actually, from this whole thing. I'm summing up more your points.
Yeah.
I always say that if you do nothing else, if you learn nothing else, but you keep asking yourself the same question on every point, and that your log line, your outline, your scenes, your dialogue, what's the compelling goal?
Right.
What's the insurmountable obstacle?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the life or death stakes? And right. if you can keep answering that with those adjectives, then you're in good shape.
Yeah. Over and over.
Over and over and over.
Scene after scene.
You got to keep asking.
Yeah. You got to
start with the log line, get through all your act breaks,
yeah.
then go through all your scenes and just make sure. And if you have those things, really all these other lessons kind of are just rips those.
And they fall in line with those. Yeah.
They fall in line.
Yeah, my lesson learned would be make it harder. Like I said, make it as hard as possible for your characters to achieve their goals. And then when they succeed, it makes it feel like it's a well-earned victory. You know, it's satisfying because you watch them overcome all of these obstacles.
And I'm going to say mine is outside of always put a Halo jump in there. I want to say mine is that the weight of guilt can actually fuel
An entire movie.
Yeah. I mean, like, that stuck with me throughout the entire runtime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it was such a prominent theme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, they started it from the very first scene.
Right. And I think that the helicopter chase is so insane and there's such a small degree of success that at that point, it's almost like you can just feel that it's run purely on guilt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It will do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's literally impossible. Right? They know the title of the movie. That's the lesson is that Chris McQuarrie knows what the title is. Start with the title and work your way backwards. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it, guys.
I agree.
Yeah.
I had fun.
Mission Impossible 6.
A Mission Impossible to talk about this.
Chose to accept it.
Well, you guys kind of decided I chose to accept it.
I'm so glad we talked about this.
I am too. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Go see it if it's still out when this is coming out.
I saw it last night.
Yeah, it's all last night. This will be out tomorrow, so go see it.
This podcast will self-destruct in
15 seconds.
And Chris McQuarrie, Chris, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. And Tom.
And Simon Pegg. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
You have just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.